Right. Well, both of us are sitting here in our respective chairs, coming together after a journey towards, I guess, this moment. I'm Wayne Petherick, and I'm here with my good friend and colleague, Grant Cinnamon, and welcome to our podcast. This is the, I guess, the first recording that we're doing, and both very excited to be here, both very excited to be starting on this podcast journey, and we hope that you will enjoy listening to it as much as we enjoyed putting it together.
Absolutely. This is our typical coffee lounge conversations that we've been having for many years together, and we figured, you know what, we could take others on a bit of a guide with us, so welcome.
And hindsight's a wonderful thing, but if only we'd have recorded all of those coffee conversations over the years, we'd probably have a couple of years worth of material to start with.
Absolutely. Better late than never.
Well, we're here now, and that's all that matters.
That's it. One of the things I think is going to be very exciting is over the coming period, we're going to, as I said, be guides, I guess, for those of you who are going to join us in a whole range of topics around the area of the psychology of criminal and antisocial behaviour. That's a fairly broad topic, and we will explore lots of different things. And as we go, obviously we'll introduce you. The topic, or the title, has come from a book of the same name that Wayne and I edited together going back several years ago now. 2017, that book was produced. It's turned out to be quite an influential book. It's used around the world by various people, and was a bit of a labour of love. We've had some wonderful people from around the world contribute to that book. And so we're going to revisit some of those topics in the book and revisit lots of other topics as well. We'll get to that in due course. But I find that it's a good place to start is always at the beginning. And one of the things that always interests me is, how do people get to where they are? And that's probably how I ended up as a clinical psychologist and as someone working in this field, was my interest in how does one person become president or prime minister or an Olympic medalist, and someone else who's been through similar experiences ends up in prison or in some other less ideal outcome in life. So here is Wayne and I sitting together having this conversation, and what interests me is how we got here. So Wayne, why here? Criminology, how did you end up as a forensic criminologist?
That was a journey that potentially started when I was a young kid. If I sort of remember back to my early years, I some of the things that I remember first are crime related, or related to aberrant or unusual behaviour. I remember the footage of the SAS raiding the Iranian embassy when it was taken over by terrorists.
So that was in London?
It was in London, yep. Yeah. And obviously that received sort of worldwide attention, and maybe that was also the moment in time that my interest in the military was sparked as well, because, you know, fast forward many years, I served in both the reserve forces and the regular army. And I'll get to that, I guess, in a minute. But I also remember the Dingo Ate My Baby, the Lindy Chamberlain case. It was very high profile at the time, and I remember sitting there glued to the screen as a kid watching that. And I also remember the fake abduction of Fairly Arrow, a singer who was on the Gold Coast. And so some of those things I tend to remember from my youth were crime related, and I'm sitting here today looking back, you know, vocalizing that and wondering if that's where my passion started. But I went through school, undiagnosed ADHD, so my grades weren't great. University wasn't really an option for me, and I saw Mr. Scott, who was the high school guidance counselor, and he said, well, if you don't know what to do, don't do anything. So that's kind of what I did for a year. I worked a couple of odd jobs. I'd had a job that I'd worked in since I was about 14 years of age as casual. I kicked around and tried a couple of different jobs to see if they might be a career for me, and nothing really took me. But by that time I joined the Army Reserve, and I really enjoyed the reserve service. I went away on a big exercise to the Northern Territory. We went out bush a couple of times and got to shoot rifles, and, you know, in the reserve forces, you'd often refer to it as going camping. So he'd go out bush, and I enjoyed it so much I decided to go regular army. Very, very interested in the armoured corps with the tanks and the armoured personnel carriers. So I was successful in joining the Royal Australian Armoured Corps at the end of my basic training. And then I got out of the army because I was in a peacetime army, and we always used to joke about, what are we going to do today? Are we going to paint some rocks? We seem to do a lot of landscaping as a peacetime army, repainting vehicles and what have you. And this was before the Australian military really had these big overseas commitments. We'd always contributed to UN missions and things like that, but there was no, this was long before, well, Desert Storm 1 happened when we
We're talking late 80s into the 90s.
Late 80s, yep. I joined in 89 and I got out at the tail end of 93.
Yeah. That was the Desert Storm 1.
I do remember, if I can digress very quickly with a humorous story, I was out bush on exercise for 6 weeks when Gulf War 1 hit, and there was only one guy who had a Walkman. And I was driving a mortar carrier at the time, so the mortars fire out of a big hole in the back of the APC. And we were listening to the ABC news footage of the Gulf War 1 happening. And he had his Walkman up there with a set of speakers just positioned on top of the armoured personnel carrier. And they got a fire mission in for the mortar battery. So we weren't thinking about it. Guys just started dropping bombs down the mortar tube. And the first one that went down, the percussion wave, the coming out of the mortar, just decimated the speakers and the Walkman. So we were left out bush now without any news about what was happening over in the Gulf War. So, because we were listening intently, you know, are we going to go? What's going to happen? And it turned out that it was all over pretty quick, and we didn't go. But I was in a peacetime army, and I figured, I knew I wasn't a career soldier, so I figured that this is probably a job where you're better off getting out of the way and just letting the career soldiers do their thing. So, like many people, when they leave the military, I wondered what I was going to do, and I thought of swapping one uniform for another. So I looked at becoming a police officer. At the time, to become a police officer, you had to have, it was either 12 or 18 months worth of study to be able to join, go to the academy. So I started studying law because I thought, hey, police, law, hand in glove. And I'd exhausted the law subjects that I could take as part of my course. And there was one called Human Behaviour Perspectives for Police, taught by a guy called Don Johnson. Not the Don Johnson, but a Don Johnson. And he was very interesting. He was a social worker, and he taught at the police academy, taught all aspects of things like mental health and what to do when you turn up to a scene and there's somebody suffering mental health problems there. And this absolutely fascinated me. And then I thought at the time that maybe I want to be a psychologist. Maybe that's the path I should go down. So because I'd done a little bit of study, they wanted me to do a little bit more because it had been years since I'd studied. So I studied externally for 12 months after I got out of the army, then applied for a full-time program and got accepted to do my Bachelor of Social Science Psychology, which I did. And over the years, I'd had experience with many different lecturers, many different backgrounds, and it was one I particularly liked. I thought she was fantastic. She was a really great lecturer. Her name was Dr. Tricia Fox. And Trish had not only worked in the prison systems in Australia, but also in Canada, where she lived for a number of years. And she had these unbelievable stories, very, very interesting. And sort of looking back now, I remember whenever I was given the opportunity to pick a topic of an essay or an assessment item, I'd always pick something to do with crime. And so looking back now, I realise I had this interest. And on my last day of my undergraduate, I went to Trish and I said, I'm lost. I don't know what to do. I've been accepted into these fourth year programs to do my honours in psychology, to go through and get registration. And I don't think I want to be a psychologist. And Trish looked at me and said, no offence, but I don't think you want to be a psychologist either. She said, I can't really see you sitting in a therapy session. It's not something I can envision you doing. And I was obviously a little bit taken aback at the time. She wasn't making it wasn't a personal attack or a personal commentary. It was just what she'd seen of me as a student. And she said to me at the time, I think you'd be much better off studying criminology. So I said, what's that? And she said, hey, ring this mob. They've got a program. And yeah, they might be able to tell you a little bit more about it. So I did what Trish said. I rang them, and it was late on a Friday afternoon. I left a voicemail. I thought, I'll never hear from them again. And then literally 9:01 on a Monday morning, I got a phone call back saying, hey, come on down. We want to talk to you and have a look at the place and see if you're interested. I went down for the day. I got the grand tour. And he said to me, I'm offering you a place right now if you'd like to do your master's with us. So I did. I enrolled in my master's of criminology, and I loved that more than anything I'd studied previously. But also more so being a postgraduate student now, I loved the little bit extra freedom we had in terms of picking our own topics and things. And after studying for a couple of semesters, I leaving class one day, and the lecturer said, hey, who wants to grab a beer? So we all went to the tavern on campus, and she had the paperwork for the coming semester. So she was looking through it going, oh my God, that subject's got like 150 students. Oh my God, this subject's got like 120 students. too many students. I can't do all that myself. So she looked at me and said, would you like some work? And I'd never gone to university with the idea of becoming an academic. I was always there. That postgraduate degree was a stepping stone to get me into an industry job. But I started doing some tutoring, and I found that I really enjoyed it, and time had come to pick a subject to do a special study. And one of the lecturers said to me, would we want to put this subject on criminal profiling together? Would you be interested in doing that as your special topic? And I said, absolutely, I would. So to me, when I was told to put the subject together, that meant write the subject, get the reading materials together, get your tutorial or case study activities together. So after a period of time, I'd gone back to this lecturer and said, hey, here's the subject. And she looked at it and went, you've literally written the entire subject. And she said, all I meant was like just to go and put a few points down of what we might cover, a bit of a synopsis. And by accident, I'd effectively written an entire subject. So the next thing to come was, would you like to teach that subject as well? So by this time, I was teaching a full subject and tutoring in a couple of other subjects. And opportunities came along as opportunities do. And it just so happened my starting work there was, you know, right place, right time. And I had a lot of these right place, right time moments where I just found myself in a room with a person that ended up presenting me with opportunities. So I was working as a research assistant at the time, as well as doing some lecturing and tutoring. But again, at the time, that was not my goal. My goal was to get my master's and go away and get an industry job. It just so happened I never left, and I ended up being there for nearly 25 years. And what I've realized looking back was that all the things I loved about my undergraduate degree, being in a class and those you know, the debates that you get involved in, challenging somebody on their idea and having this really respectful intellectual discourse, I loved that. I thought that was great. And I realized that the reason I stayed was because I now got to do what I loved as an undergraduate, but I was getting paid to do it. And so that's why I stayed. And then, you know, fast forward a couple of years, I was teaching a subject with one of the only books on the topic at the time that I complained about incessantly to a colleague. And he said, look, I'm basically sick of this. If you don't like the book, go and write a better one. And I said, well, who am I to write a book? I'm just this, you know, guy that's doing some lecturing and tutoring. And he said, well, you're complaining about the quality of the other books in the area. Do you think you could do better? I said, I think I could. And he goes, right, go and do it.
Go and do it.
So yeah. I did. And I wrote the first edition of Profiling in Serial Crime, which was a book that, you know, our Grant and my first collaboration together was
absolutely
in that
the
book.
The third edition.
Yeah. And that was the start of much collaboration. And it turned out I'd reconnected with Grant because I was being sent interstate and on a marketing visit, and I'd put up on Facebook, does anybody live in South Australia and can or anybody knows anything about South Australia, tell me where's a good place to stay.
Yeah.
And within seconds, people you may know, Grant popped up. So I'm like, holy crap, that's Grant. I haven't seen him for years. Hadn't seen him for God knows how many years. I don't even want to say out loud how many years had passed by. And so I added him on Facebook and we reconnected. And then over the years, we'd sort of worked together on projects. We'd worked together teaching. And then I was, again, sick of the quality of the books that were around in one of my subject areas. So I sort of went to Grant and we sat down, had one of our coffees, and I said, hey, look, here's a book idea. What do you think? And we wrote that book. We had some unbelievably high caliber contributors to that book who all jumped in.
Global contributors. Global, yeah. Yep. That was a truly international effort, wasn't it?
It was. And they're not just people who are international. They are internationally recognized in their field as well. We had some very heavy hitters in that book. And, you know, fast forward again a few years, I'd published a few more books. I'd actually managed to get myself a bit of an international reputation as well. I started getting invitations to do guest lectures via Skype and Zoom and all that to universities in South America. I'd lectured in the United States as well. I'd done formal sessions in upstate New York for the New York State Police, New York State Patrol, and a few other police agencies, the Olean Police, the local police. So I'd been doing all these things, not really thinking about it and about what it all meant. I was like, that was my job at the time. I just kept doing it. But over the years, I'd actually managed to, I guess the word would be, amass a fairly significant portfolio of teaching expertise, publications, a little bit of research work, but also being asked to be, you know, keynote speaker or speakers at conferences and things like that. And I never really thought a lot about it because to me, I was just doing the job that I was paid to do. And a little while ago, Grant and I were sitting around and sort of, I think we both had the idea almost at the same time as we were talking about it. And we said, hey, what about a podcast? And we know that everybody loves podcasts. They're a huge thing at the moment. And we are entering a market that is fairly saturated with this content. But we're confident that we have a product that's going to be delivered with content and format that no other podcast in this space covers. And part of that is the way we're doing it is just a conversation between a couple of guys who've known each other for, we don't even want to say out loud how long, and talking about things that we find interesting and we are passionate about, but those things that we also know you will be interested in and passionate about, and that's why we're here. So that's why I'm here, especially. But I'd also like to hear Grant's story, because as far as I'm concerned, I think my story, it's interesting to me, but I don't know how interesting it is to other people. But it's always interesting to know. The first thing I did at university, when I had a lecturer I had not had before, I would go up to them and ask them about their background. Where did you come from? Why are you here? And to me, that was always interesting, because that told you a little bit about why they did what they did, the directions they'd taken in life. And so hearing these backstories, and you meet some amazing people and hear some amazing stories. And I think Grant's story is an amazing one.
I love that. I'm a big fan of serendipity, those moments, you know, the sliding door moments in life where you happen to turn right instead of left and the rest is history, as they say. Our chance reconnection in Adelaide's a very, very good example of that after a few decades of being out of school and moving forward. And I guess my story is a little bit different in the context that I wanted to be a psychologist from a very young age. That was my thing. I loved helping people. I loved being in that space, and that's what I wanted. But it took a bit of a turn to start. Wayne and I went to the same school together, and I can still remember my careers planning day at the school, and the teacher coming up to me and saying, you know, what are you thinking about wanting to study when you go to university? And I said, oh, I want to be a psychologist. And she laughed in my face and said, don't be ridiculous, you're going to be a PE teacher. I was a bit sporty at the time, and everyone just assumed that I'd do something related to sport.
One of the things that you'll come to appreciate about Grant is he tends to undersell himself. When he says he was a little bit good at sport, he was actually really good. And we all, I was in the grade below him, and I know that my mates and that younger cohort always looked at Grant on the sports field with much admiration, because he was a great sportsman.
Ah, thank you. But it was interesting, because I guess the teachers thought the same thing and thought my legs were much better performers than my brain, shall we say, when I was at high school. And that was that. You're going to be a PE teacher. Not long after, because of my sport, ironically, I changed schools. And the day that I started at my new school, they had already organised their high school work experience. And so the organiser came up to me and said, well, Grant, you know, you've just started with us and we've got work experience in a couple of weeks and we've organised everything, but what do you want to do? And I said, I want to be a psychologist. And she didn't even bat, and she ironically was the PE teacher at the time and knew me obviously because of my sport, and said, didn't bat an eyelid, said, let me see what I can do. And 3 days later, she came back and said, we've got you 2 weeks work experience with the Australian Institute of Sport. And that was that. And I went away to Brisbane for 2 weeks, and the head sports psychologist at the Australian Institute of Sport in Brisbane, so in Queensland here in Australia, was also a forensic psychologist. And that was his two areas of expertise. And so I spent half my time with the squash and diving teams at the Australian Institute of Sport, as well as with the Brisbane Bullets basketball and the Queensland Reds rugby union. And the other half, working with him, obviously I couldn't go into sessions, but talking about forensic cases. And I sat in the car park for hours at Boggo Road Jail while he went into the jail to interview people, were never allowed in, and was hooked on both areas and loved it. But the thing that I loved most was this idea of how do people get to where they are and why do they make the decisions they do? And why, as two people who come from a seemingly same background, why do they make such profoundly different choices or end up in such profoundly different places? And that's what fascinated me about psychology and what can we do to assist people in that journey and to influence those more resourceful choices that create more resourceful outcomes. And that's really where I've been. And the other side of that coin that led me into this kind of area was this notion of how do people manipulate others to get them to do those outcomes? And I remember looking at things like war crimes and genocide and these areas and being fascinated, because very early I could see these experiences on a very big scale. You know, if we talk about the Holocaust, or we talk about Pol Pot regime, we talk about what happened in the Balkans and Rwanda and these places, that people talked about ideology as being this evil thing. And the thing I could always see behind it was that it was a manipulation of ideology. And how does that happen on a mass scale? And that's really the sociological element, not a psychological element, because psychology is very much about the individual, whereas the sociological part of that is very much about the group.
The group, the collective.
And I was fascinated by both. And criminology and a lot of this space is where they intersect. And that's why I think that side of it interested me so much. The psychology side of it interested me because I wanted to say, well, what could I do? What could I do to help influence people in a different way? And as a psychologist, that's what my job is. So that's kind of how I moved into this field. The idea of Wayne and I coming together to work was really a serendipitous moment. You were working on the third edition of serial crime profiling, and we contributed to one of the chapters
and
looked at the characteristics of the profiles of victims and so forth, and sort of the rest, as they say, is history.
And that chapter really is, that I guess was the seed that became a lot of your other work that we did in the book, relating to victim vulnerabilities and things like that. And that's one topic that's going to have a really central role in this podcast, because one, it's massive. Two, it's important because it will dictate whether or not somebody becomes a victim or on the other hand, a criminal. Yeah. But it's also something that has such an unbelievable impact. And it's a very controversial area, because unfortunately, historically, that when we talk about vulnerabilities, people feel like you're blaming the person for becoming a victim. But what we're really trying to do is, and this is a very important distinction I think we will talk about now, but also repeat over and over again through the series, is that as Grant, as a psychologist, his job is to understand and then to put things in place that help a person grow, become, in some cases, a more functional person. My job as a criminologist is also to understand, but I'm not looking to help restore somebody to a previous state. My job is to try to understand what happened and explain it in a way that makes sense to another person. And so we have this unbelievably serendipitous dovetail between my work and Grant's work that has allowed us to come together to put this podcast out there.
And I think there's two components that really fit with that is prevention and intervention.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and from that sociological, criminological understanding of things, if we understand how that happens, we can work to prevent that from happening. Whereas within a psychological context, we're talking about intervening when it has happened, whether that's a perpetrator or a victim in that mindset. And that is very much, I have a great passion for both of those, so this is the space that lets that happen. You know, half of my work is very much looking, particularly my international work, is very much around prevention. How do we prevent these things from happening? How do we use education? How do we use knowledge? How do we use cultural change and information to prevent crimes and in some scales, very large scale sort of crimes from happening? The other side of it is the intervention. If it has happened, how do we assist people to restore? How do we assist people to move forward in their lives? And I love the fact that this is where that connects up.
Where it's all come together.
Vulnerabilities is a really, as you well know, Wayne, when I talk, vulnerability is something that comes up all the time. And as I said, not as a weakness. Vulnerabilities are not weakness. Vulnerabilities are often some of our greatest vulnerabilities are some of our greatest character strengths.
Absolutely.
Trust, always looking on the bright side of life, wanting to help other people. All of these things, they can be great strengths or great elements of our character, but they can also render us vulnerable to those who would be predatory in nature and who would know how to manipulate us because of those factors.
And if we look at, say, an individual person, and that person has a personality or a character trait that they like to see the good in people, that person will then be more prone to predation by somebody looking to exploit that. And so it's such a critical difference, and it's such an emotional conversation that happens when you have it, because inevitably somebody will come back to, well, why are you blaming him? But we don't, if you fall for the Nigerian prince email because you're having money troubles, we're not blaming you for that, but we're identifying that the money trouble gave you a vulnerability that made you more open to exploitation. If you're lonely, you might be more prone to falling victim for romance scams or something along those lines. So our job's not to come and place a value judgment on what you did or why you did it. Our job is to come along and try to understand it and to be able to then explain it to another person, whether that other person be the victim themselves, a family member, or a group, a collective that you identify as being particularly prone to exploitation. Could be the police, the prisons, the court system. Our job is to come along and try to understand these events to be able to then facilitate some type of change or improvement.
Absolutely. I think maybe a good analogy to draw to this is somebody who loves the ocean. There's no weakness in loving the ocean, but it makes you more vulnerable to drowning because you're going to be more close to water. So therefore, being aware of that, being aware that a vulnerability through loving the ocean is potential drowning or some disaster that's associated with water, we're more likely to wear a life jacket in certain circumstances. That's what we're talking about.
Yep.
It doesn't mean it's a weakness. It means you're vulnerable, and therefore understanding what makes us vulnerable to certain sets of circumstances or certain sets of people who would want to take advantage of that allows us to be aware and to potentially put things in place that prevents. And that's the education process that comes from that. When we put this into a personal space where we talk about vulnerability to crime, to predatory behaviours, and you know, a lot of my work is around sexual grooming and these kinds of spaces of personal violence, and particularly gender-based violence. Mm-hmm. By being aware of those vulnerabilities, by educating people, we're able to protect ourselves much more. And I think that's a really big key to that. It's not a weakness, it's a vulnerability.
Yeah. And I think being able to help somebody identify their vulnerabilities is a powerful thing, because then what we've started to do is we've started to move towards that prevention idea, where we can help protect people and protect their loved ones and those around them. And this we started with this idea of a podcast, not really knowing what it was going to look like. And over time, we've developed this idea that's just going to be a couple of mates sitting around having a chat like we do regularly over a coffee, but we're just going to record them. And so it's going to serve not only as something that's informative and we hope a little bit entertaining, but it will also be educational. And we'll be talking about things you may identify. Some of the things we talk about may personally resonate with you, either because of a direct experience you've had or because of something that's happened with your family. I always remember when you'd ask students, why are you studying criminology? Oh, our house got broken into once and I want to learn more about the people who do that. Oh, I was sexually assaulted, or I was date raped, or any of these number of horrible things that can happen to people. But that's why they are drawn towards those fields. And that's, it's the idea of compensatory behavior. You know, if you've, a lot of what I found, and this is a personal experience, what I found is a lot of people who study law have had legal problems in the past. Some people who study psychology have had emotional problems that they're trying to help them understand. Some people who study criminology have been victims. And so we're going to talk about this, but we've individually put together a list of topics that I think is many dozens, if not potentially hundreds, of things that we're going to talk about. And in the coming weeks, months, or years, what we're going to do is present these ideas to you in a very relaxed and sort of open conversation between Grant and I, where we'll share our knowledge and our experience with you. And hopefully, if out of anyone who listens to this, if we can help or educate one person, then we've done our job.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that I'm really looking forward to as part of this conversation is, through the very wide network of individuals that we know, some amazing people in these fields, that we'll be able to share with you their experiences as well. And we'll have a number of guests come on with us who are going to be able to shed some incredible insight and incredible expertise across a range of topics that fall into that psychology of criminal and antisocial behaviour and the consequences of that behaviour with you. So that's going to be quite exciting as well.
We've got a couple of people that are lined up out the door already, a couple of people who've been victims of crime, but also people who've spent time in prison. We're going to hear about their experiences and what happened. And one of the things that I think you will come to appreciate if you don't already is that prisons are full of good people who found themselves in incredibly difficult or bad situations. And so we're going to talk about what that looks like and how that happens as well. And if I just go completely off the top of my head, the kinds of things that I'm interested in that we're going to talk about, and Grant will add his list as well, things like the vulnerability that we talked about, but also victimology and victimization. What are the factors that go into that? We're going to be looking at things like school shootings. We're going to be talking to an expert in mass shooting incidents from the United States, who's actually also a former student of mine. He's now widely recognized being an expert in school shootings. We're going to talk about cults, because they are very destructive groups, very influential, very powerful groups in some cases. And we're going to look at why people join cults. And it may come as no surprise that people tend to join cults not because they're dumb, because they have low IQ, it's because they're vulnerable at a particular point in time, and the cult comes along and offers them something that they feel might be beneficial or helpful to them. But we're also going to talk about things like conspiracy theories. This is unbelievably timely at the moment, having just come out of a global pandemic. We saw a whole rash of new conspiracy theories come out that adds to the laundry list of already existing conspiracy theories. And I think that is a topic that I absolutely love talking about, and I think you'll enjoy hearing. But Grant's got a similar list of his own, and I'll let him add to that now.
I think the big theme that you'll hear from me is, as I was talking about, is the vulnerabilities. And whether we talk about cults, whether we talk about conspiracy theories, whether we talk about victimology in the context of what results in someone becoming a victim of crime, whether we talk about perpetration of crime, and that's something that Wayne and I have talked about a lot in the context of people that we know who have spent time in prison.
Mm-hmm.
And you think about their experiences from one moment in life to being in prison and then the consequences of that beyond. Is there but for the grace of God go I? And you think about how, and I think I mentioned it earlier, is this notion of sliding door moments where we have a confluence of experience, we end up in a particular spot, we meet one person that makes one suggestion, we meet somebody else who makes another suggestion, or an opportunity, and I use that in inverted commas, presents itself and we make a choice that results in a less than ideal outcome versus somebody who makes an alternative choice that ends up in a more beneficial outcome. They're the things that I'm going to be very interested to share with you and talk to you about, and whether that's in the context of war crimes and genocide, whether that's in the context of global politics and the notion of what happens behind that. Unfortunately, in this moment, we're experiencing in the Middle East some very unfortunate events with Israel and Hamas. These things, what does it look like with that? Whether it's individual crime, sexual assault, financial crime, scams on the internet, all of these things are about what makes us vulnerable, how do we protect ourselves, how do we educate ourselves without losing what makes us us. And I think that's a really big conversation that we have in this, is Wayne and I talk a lot about, well, how do we ensure, to the extent we can, ourselves against predation without building walls in front of us and hiding behind iron fences to stop ourselves. We've got to be able to still be human and have the human experience. And so that's going to be a big part of what's going to interest me in the conversations.
Absolutely. And if you've got somebody who allows themselves to be cloistered away because of their fear, then what you've got is somebody who's not being able to enjoy their life to the full. And so we're going to talk a lot about the balance, you know, being difference between being alert and not alarmed, you know, being able to go about your daily life, living your life in whatever environment you live in and be free from predation. We're going to talk about that a lot as well, and how some of the best ways to achieve that. And so that is the information and the education part of what we do. But overall, what we want to do is the idea behind this, the one word we come back to every time we talk about this podcast, every time we talk about the collaborations that we're going to do together, the one word that keeps coming out is fun. Now, I know it might seem to be a little bit of a weird juxtaposition when we're talking about crime.
Fun and crime. That's
fun
exactly
and crime. But there's no reason that this has to be morbid or negative. A lot of these things, we talk about things, you know, with psychological disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, but there's also post-traumatic growth. People can learn and they can grow and evolve, rise from the fires like a phoenix by allowing themselves to be educated.
Absolutely. And I would, on that point, also say that so much of what we talk about is about what we do as a collective in society as well. One of my absolute favorite sayings, I actually wrote it in the front of a book that I gave as a gift to one of my staff this week. We are each of us like angels with only one wing, and we can only fly by embracing each other. And I think this whole notion of vulnerability, this whole notion of what leads to crime, what puts us in a situation where we're either vulnerable to crime or vulnerable to the influences that would make us criminal in nature, you know, commit crime, is this very notion of what makes us as a society and how do we interact and how do we connect with one another. And there's lots of very interesting things that we'll talk about in that context too, of the notions of social connectedness and the sort of social cohesion that allows us to be part of something bigger than ourselves that influences who we are and what we do and why we do it.
Yeah, we do it and those we engage with. That's a big part of it. As I said before, you know, prisons are full of good people who found themselves in very bad situations. And one of the other things that we're going to talk about, which may sound controversial, but, you know, bear with us, the idea that we have these discrete categories of victim, non-victim, criminal, non-criminal. They're absolutes that we tend to use, and in the majority of contexts in which those terms are used, they're actually quite misleading and in some cases potentially damaging. So we're going to have a talk about that as well, why we don't have a dichotomy between victims and non-victims and criminals and non-criminals.
Yeah, very much so.
So that's our first episode in a nutshell, and probably the rest of the podcast in a nutshell as well. You know a little bit about the direction we're going to take, but it's going to unfold each week with potentially new directions that we hadn't even conceived of when we came up with the idea. So we'd like to invite you all to join us for that ride.
Looking forward to it.